or something?
Thanks. Am I now mic'd for the tape? Yes, right. Okay. I will be talking about strings and cosmology very briefly. But that's just by way of sort of framing the more specific topic that I want to spend two lectures on, which is inflation in string theory. Not by any means the only place where string theory arises in cosmology, but one of the exciting ones. So let me begin by talking about the sort of general kinds of areas where string theory and cosmology have been related. One is in terms of string theory scenarios for solving the cosmological constant problem. Now, as you are no doubt aware, there's no really compelling solution to the cosmological constant problem in string theory or outside of it. But there's a somewhat compelling scenario due to Busso and Polchinski for at least accommodating the small vacuum creation. And I'm not going to have much to say about that. I just wanted to point out that this is a large area of investigation that fits under this sort of general scheme. Another area I'm not going to talk about at all is cosmic superstrings. Clearly a case where you could get direct evidence of truly stringy behavior or superstring behavior from cosmological observations. Won't talk about that much. Another thing is stringy ideas about dark matter. This is almost an empty set. There are just a couple of ideas, fairly interesting ones. And you can sort of guess why there wouldn't be too many ideas. It's just a matter of scales. Dark matter is something that's most likely relevant at the TeV scale, at least for a wimp. And string theory generically has not much to say about the TeV scale. So this, too, I'm not going to be talking about. And then we have ideas like brain gas cosmology. Which is a non-inflationary proposal for understanding the early universe, which tries to use ideas about intersecting strings and brains in toroidal compactification. And more generally than this, we have various sorts of non-inflationary early universe theories. Many of them string-inspired. So this includes things like the cyclic and aperiodic scenarios. Which do not exist just because of string theory. Could have been thought of, as I understand things, quite well in quantum field theory coupled to gravity, but take some of their inspiration and some of the strength from extra-dimensional motivation, you might call it. There are other kinds of extra-dimensional or brain world scenarios. Involving inflation on brains of various dimensionalities, and then also mirage cosmologies. And then a wide host of other ideas. Okay. And this is just to say what it is that I could very well try to talk about, but I'm not going to. Instead, I'm going to talk about what's perhaps the most conservative of all of these, which is to take something which you've just been hearing quite a lot about, which we know works very well in field theory, inflation, and which we know is in excellent agreement with observations, and then try and understand, is this something that we can realize in string theory, and does it help inflation or string theory to put the two together? Okay, So what's the motivation for doing inflation in field theory? By the way, I should say before I go on, I hope you'll interrupt with a lot of questions, because to some extent, I'm going to tailor the subjects that I actually describe in detail to the questions. So please, please don't hesitate. The first motivation is, well, maybe this is a place where we could really use string theory and use it to what end? Well, ideally to address shortcomings of the basic paradigm. The basic paradigm that we would try to move beyond is quantum field theory plus QR. So we want to try and overcome shortcomings of the QFT plus GR inflation paradigm. And it's going to be quite important, not necessarily in this talk, maybe next time, for me to explain exactly what are those shortcomings. But some of them will have been evident to you from Will's talk, because there were a variety of things which where Will is referring to a wide range of possibilities. In general, the general shortcoming I'd like you to have in mind for this lecture, at least, is that this whole framework is not very constraining. As Will said, almost any function you think of, you can find a way to tweak it to make it inflate. And that's actually too much freedom. If you have a whole function's worth of freedom, and we're only going to measure a handful of cosmological parameters, it's not predictive. So that's one shortcoming we'd like to address. So that's under the scheme of using string theory, but how about more positively try to test string theory? And here I want to be fairly clear. I want to try and spell things out. There are three different kinds of levels of testing string theory. One is string theory consistent with observation? Observations that have already been done, in particular, the horizon and flatness problems. The solution of the horizon and flatness problems through some mechanism. Is inflation consistent with the large, flat, homogeneous universe we see today? And it better be, otherwise we would have to move on very rapidly. Something which would be a good deal nicer than a positive answer to one is restricting our attention to subsectors of string theory. So I've not yet said we're going to rule out string theory, but we could rule out different little pieces of the framework. For example, you might say, well, maybe we can rule out the type 2B theory, or maybe we can rule out a construction involving the standard model on D6 brains in type A, or something like that, type 2A. That's what I mean by restricting attention to subsectors. Actually using observational constraints to do that. And then third and most grand and unlikely is to give evidence that's for or against string theory as a whole structure. Now, I will come back again and again to ways that we might try to do this. But I'm not promising to achieve this. And the best that I'll promise to do is step two, to show you how to rule out different subsectors given certain data. So the sort of general scheme is how can we achieve inflation in string theory, and what are the special challenges? That's what I want to talk about today. And next. And let me say just one more thing by way of orientation. The goal, I want to equip you to shoot down virtually any model of string inflation. And I say this not to make fun of the state of the field, because many of us, certainly myself included, are trying very hard to make good models of string inflation. But they all suffer from a variety of shortcomings, many of which appear again and again, and to some extent go unrecognized, And I'm going to harp on those shortcomings so that whenever you hear a seminar about string inflation, you will recognize immediately the flaws that are being exposed there. So I want to equip you to assess very critically any string inflation model. Now, that's going to require a certain number of technical tools. So to a large extent today, I'm going to be talking about much more detailed versions of this motivation and technical tools for moduli stabilization, which are really the ingredients you need to form a sharp assessment of a string inflation. Any questions about the scheme? I'm going to summarize what Will said, the parts that are really essential for me, in very easy notation. So unlike Will, I'm going to use unreduced Planck mass. I'm going to use reduced Planck mass units. So m Planck here is different by a factor of square root of 8 pi for what he was writing. So that was his notation. This capital N is mine. And this is 2.4 times 10 to the 18th eV. As is completely conventional, I'll define h as a dot over a, where dot is the derivative with respect to time, not the conformal parameter tau. The Lagrangian solvers referring to take the completely standard form this for a single scalar field. The Friedman equation is just 3h squared m Planck squared equals v of phi in the slow roll, which I will be assuming throughout. And then the slow roll parameters are eta, which is the curvature of the potential in Planck units, v double prime over v, and epsilon, which has a factor of 1/2, and then v prime over v squared. So these are the basic definitions that we'll need for talking about inflation. Now, there are much more complicated Lagrangians that people use for many of the most exciting models. I'm talking about these ones because I want to introduce the tools first, and then maybe in the second lecture I'll say something about the more complicated ones. Okay. So something which you might think is obvious, but I'm convinced by long consideration of the way that string inflation papers are produced, I'm convinced that this is not completely obvious to everyone, what I'm going to call the goal of string inflation. And here I mean a really conservative goal, a goal for the very first iteration, just to be sure that we have a model of string inflation, not to make an exciting model yet. Okay. So don't complain yet that this is too boring. Don't complain yet that you can complain that the presentation is boring, but not that the attempt here. What I'm going to try and do here is something very straightforward. Just get inflation in string theory, period, and not worry about whether it's exciting inflation yet. So the goal is find a configuration C of string theory data. I'll call it compactification data. That leads to a 4D theory with a Lagrangian suitable for inflation. And in line with my assumptions stated previously, I'm really going to mean suitable for slow roll single field inflation. But it could be more exotic in the end. And what constraints am I going to put on this configuration? There are actually a lot of requirements on C. First of all, C should be something that's consistent with the equations of motion that descend from string theory. So it should be a solution of the equations of motion. Uh, And there are various aspects of that consistency that are important in different contexts. One of them is anomalies. That's rarely a problem in these setups. People usually take care of that. Tadpole problems, i.e., every sort of Gauss's law constraint is obeyed. You don't have any uncancelled charges in compact spaces. And this is not a firm requirement, but I'm going to be assuming it here. Typically, one assumes that C is such that supersymmetry is preserved at least at very high scales, very, very high, around the compactification scale. Now, should be clear, inflation is a quasi-De Sitter epoch. De Sitter space breaks all supersymmetry. I'm not saying we should choose a configuration that always preserves supersymmetry. It breaks supersymmetry at least at the scale of inflation, which could be, say, 10 to the 16 GeV. But at least I want the compactification itself to be supersymmetric before that, so I can do the KK reduction in a supersymmetric framework. We'll try and get around that one too, but I'm going to assume this for now. C should also be computable and controllable. We have two expansions of primary importance in string theory, the large volume sigma model expansion. If R is a generic radius of curvature, then the expansion is in alpha prime over R squared, and we require this parameter to be small compared to 1. And also, we require G string to be small compared to 1. So large volume and weak coupling. This one's a personal choice. You might disagree with me. C should be explicit. What I mean by that is that if there are any constants that appear in the 4D Lagrangian, we should compute them using the string theory data, not make them up. And if there's a function that arises in the 4D theory that descends from the string theory data, we should again compute that function rather than postulating the form. This is a bit of an ideal, but we can really get pretty close to this in works in recent years. So I'm going to impose that requirement too. And as I take you through models later on, we'll get step by step closer to that. But these are requirements, consistency and computability, that I'll be imposing throughout. OK, and one more requirement. L should not have unstabilized moduli, by which I mean light gravitationally coupled scalars. So if we find a configuration C that has these properties, and that furthermore gives rise to a Lagrangian where eta and epsilon, as defined there, are small, then we'll say we've actually constructed, we've derived a specific example of inflation. Now, what am I not recording yet? I'm not recording that L has distinctive signatures. For today's purposes, I don't mind if the signatures that L provides are completely consistent with QFT models of the equation. I'm not requiring that L is natural in string theory. I'm certainly not demanding that L could not arise in a reasonable effective field theory. And this is the source of a misconception, which probably none of you has this, but just in case someone does, let me state it. What I'm doing here is not, in the end, going to be extremely stringy. I'm trying to derive an effective quantum field theory where all of the stringy stuff has been integrated out. It'll be left behind at certain kinds of traces, correlations among the parameters in the low-energy Lagrangian. But in the end, I will have a field theory Lagrangian. So I don't think there's really much hope here of finding a Lagrangian which couldn't arise in effective field theory by constructing a Tom Rankine. Okay. Now, that's in the very long-term view, you might say that's a little bit worrisome, because how are we going to test string theory if it always has to go through the intermediary of effective field theory? And the hope is something like the following. There are no guarantees, by the way. If we're very unfortunate, then what we might achieve by doing this is prove that string theory can give rise to inflation and be totally out of luck in terms of using data to touch string theory. Or we might just say, well, fine, string theory is consistent with the data. The picture, though, that I have in mind is, so here's C, space of string theory configurations, and then here's the very large space of 4D Lagrangians. And of these 4D Lagrangians, the ones that I'm drawing here in orange, give rise to inflation. So, of course, inflationary Lagrangians are a small subset of all 4D Lagrangians. Now, what string theory does is it gives us some discrete, an incredibly large, but presumably discrete number of 4D Lagrangians. Some of them inflationary, some of them not. And the hope that I have in mind, at least, and I think most people have in mind, is that there's a systematic pattern in which parts of the 4D Lagrangian space string theory fills up. And by studying those parts and understanding their observational signatures, we can say that string theory generically predicts one or another kind of signature. But if we're incredibly unlucky, then this might be pretty uniform, and then we wouldn't get much information. In my view, it's still a better bet than trying to test string theory at the TEV scales, because here, at least, as I will argue in a lot of detail later, there are real quantum gravity problems waiting. So there are some of these shortcomings of QFT inflation are honest quantum gravity problems. So I'm going to move on to what this ends up really requiring us. Any questions? Okay. Well, C is going to have to break supersymmetry. As I said before, to get to sitter. And the potential must be flat. Reasonably flat, as defined by the epsilon and eta slow roll conditions. And then this last one is that C must not cause anything else to happen. And the other thing that one might think of that's particularly dangerous and happened in almost all models of string inflation in the 90s at least, is a decompactification instability. So the problem is, as soon as you find a way to break supersymmetry, whether or not you get a flat potential, you end up creating an instability that causes the compactification manifold to blow up the infinite body. And you go back to 10-dimensional flat space. And so what we need to do is find a way to break SUSY and not decompactify everything. That's hard enough. And then we've got to fold in this one more condition. We've also wanted to get a flat potential. It turns out that each pair of these three things is incompatible. So we have problems all over the place. And we'll find a way to hold them all together. What's the potential going to look like? I said a flat potential, well, the sort of general scheme you might think of, it could be something of a Russell binomial form, or it could be something more like what Will was drawing that has a quick feature like this. And then what actually turns out to be most likely in string theory is something which is of a hybrid sort. Up here, high on this ridge, there's a strong potential keeping the field drawn in orange for rolling at all. Then as you move closer to this turning point, that potential flattens out, and then eventually it goes tachyonic. And so once you roll on the white line down to this point, you fall off. Yes?
Yeah. And would you at any point consider that the flatness and horizon problem could be solved by something besides inflation?
Yes, certainly. So I think that there are a lot of interesting proposals for that, and those are, I mean, the ones that I first thought of are the ones I put in that circle up there. But what I'm attempting to do here is
just inflation.
The reason just inflation is, I think it's the one that, in my view, is most robust as a field theory mechanism, first of all, and is in outstanding agreement with the data. So what would be nice, if someone comes up with another field theory mechanism, in addition to those ones, say, it would be nice to try and realize those in string theory. And what would be nicest of all would be to do something, maybe not exactly Brady gas cosmology, but something that's inherently absolutely straight that solves the horizon and flat problems. But my personal opinion is that a lot of those things are not concrete enough yet, at least for giving lectures. I mean, in fact, as research problems, a lot of them are very require a certain amount of technical advance before we can even do anything. This is the one that's sort of sitting right in front of us available. We know Will was setting up a cookbook, and all I'm trying to do is feed into that, take string theory, produce a Lagrangian that will feed into the well-established construction of the question. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. I was just wondering, since you were saying that kind of model that Will was explaining have problems, like, because it doesn't address some of the quantum gravity.
Oh, so those issues,
It seems like you're still, again, trying to find an effective field theory, but maybe the scale is not appropriate.
It turns out that the effective field theory problems are fairly isolated. A large fraction of the interest in string cosmology, string inflation, comes from this kind of hope, of a systematic prediction, not from the quantum gravity problem kind of hope. The quantum gravity effects is an exciting prospect, but that actually affects only a certain fraction of models. So I'm going to spend the second lecture actually talking about that class of models and trying to explain how in string theory we can get around those problems in a sensible way. But there exists a lot of models which really end up being sensible in effective field theory. Okay, so let me try and say that a little more clearly. There are two major problems with QFT inflation model building. One of them is there's too much freedom. And the other is that some of the models have quantum gravity problems. Today, I'm addressing only the former one by trying to build models that are fairly tame, effective field theory models. And in the next lecture, I'll talk about how some if we focus on the models that have quantum gravity problems, we can try and solve those problems. Any other questions about this? About this side? Okay, so what are these inconsistencies or problems? Well, does someone know why these are inconsistent? Breaking of supersymmetry? I mean, why does breaking supersymmetry generically cause decommagnetization?
Because the potential at infinity must go to zero, so...
Precisely. We know that 10D flat space is a solution. Is a supersymmetric solution. So if I draw the potential for the volume, I'll refer to the volume as rho. I'm considering, let's say, a Calabi outcome magnification. Then at infinity, the potential has to go to zero. Now, from above or below, we don't really know. I'm going to come up with more information about that. But it's got to be here. So that means that if you have some sort of, who knows, I'll show you later, but if you have question marks here and question marks there, and you claim that you have a nice De Sitter solution here, the problem is you're always at least going to be metastable for running out this way. And at least tunnel through this barrier to decommagnification. But more importantly, it actually takes a whole lot of doing to construct these barriers. So that's the next thing. Most sources of positive energy that one can think of tend to behave like this. As steep power laws, I'm not even drawing them steep enough, causing decommagnification. So what do these curves mean? I just mean the potential for some energy source, V1 and V2, two different kinds of energy sources I think of. So let me show you a derivation of that for a specific case.
Excuse me. I just want to know if I got the idea right. So first, you're going to compactify, so you preserve supersymmetry, and then you're going to break it by putting something into the model.
Yes.
You don't do so in a controlled way, so it doesn't become...
Precisely. Yes. So the series of steps is one, Suzy compactification. Yeah, that's a good question that I'll come back to later, but let me sort of sketch it out now. Suzy compactification on the Calabi app. Two, Suzy stabilization of moduli. In other words, finding some sort of minimum here. I'm deliberately drawing this on the same graph, but below zero. This is an ADS solution. Okay, I'm going to go through all of this more slowly in a moment. Suzy stabilization. And then controllable Suzy break.
So are you going to follow like some sort of KPLT?
Yeah, exactly. How much? I understand that KKLT was not explained in full detail in Frederick's lectures. Is that fair? Will I be boring you if I go through KKLT? Then I will explain. I'm going to spend a fair portion of this on the KKLT proposal then, because that's really one of the key ingredients. KKLT and things inspired by it or generalizing it. This is really the mechanism by which we can make realistic cosmological models. Okay, let me just give you one example so it's absolutely concrete why this fall-off behavior occurs. So consider an anti-V3 ring. The action for an anti-V3 ring, consider an anti-V3 ring embedded in some four-manifold, sigma-4, in a 10-dimensional compactification, M10, which can be maybe Minkowski space times a Calabi out. Calabi out threefold, i.e. a 6-dimensional Calabi out space. Now, the DBI portion, direct one infold portion of the action for the anti-V3 brain, can be written as a sort of a delta function localization times a measure factor times the tension of the brain. In other words, it's the volume wrapped. It's the volume taken up by the brain. What do I mean by y's here? I'm considering a general line element, gmn, the big x n equals a space-time power plus an internal part. So these are 4 and 6-dimensional portions of the metric.
What is the anti-V3?
What is it? What kind of object is it? Or
it is
a D3 brain, but it carries the opposite charge under the coupling. This is an electric type coupling to the Ramon 4-form potential C4. And an anti-V3 brain is distinguished by a D3 brain by the sign of this coupling. So you can think of it as just like a D3 brain, but with opposite. Now there's a detail I'm not going into here, which is that which one is which. I mean, after all, how you define brain versus anti-brain depends on some data of the background. But I'll leave that aside. So it's a 3+1-dimensional object, first of all. And what I'm doing is I'm going to embed it along the space-time. I'm going to make sigma-4 be identified with the space-time. So here I have some Calabi out space times space-time. And I'm going to take the D3 bar, and it's going to fill space-time and be a point in the Calabi out space. It's not extended in the Calabi out. Okay? And if you don't like the way I wrote the action, then I'll write it one different way. As the integral in some coordinates native to the brain, C1 through C4, of the induced metric on the brain. In other words, I just take the ambient metric in the Calabi space and I pull it back to the anti-brain. And what if this tension, TV3 bar, is 1 over 2 pi cubed 1 over g string times 1 over alpha prime squared. Which is to say the tension is roughly of order the string mass to the fourth power, including an extra factor of g string. Questions about what this is? Does it say something more about the antibrain itself before I explain why it gives a deeper magnification instability? Okay. So the total action is the Einstein-Hilbert action plus the DBI action plus a Chern-Simons coupling. This coupling here, this electric coupling, which I'm going to omit. I hope the experts will forgive me. I'm going to leave that out. I'm just going to focus on the Einstein-Hilbert coupling, Einstein-Hilbert action, and the DBI term. Now, the Einstein-Hilbert action, as you know, is just like that in 10 dimensions. And for later use, I'm going to put the constant out front, where kappa 10, just like the four-dimensional kappa, this is the gravitational coupling strength, and it's given by the following expression in terms of the string coupling and the string tension. Now, the point is I want to take this 10-dimensional action. After all, the reason I wrote this Born-Infeld thing with a delta function localization instead of in this native four-dimensional form, is that I want to take these two 10-dimensional actions and dimensionally reduce to 4D and see what I get. Now, when I reduce this to four dimensions, this Einstein-Hilbert term, well, the 10-dimensional Ricci scalar is going to break up into the four-dimensional Ricci scalar plus some other terms. But this integral is over, I mean, this is a 10-dimensional measure. And I'm going to do a 6-dimensional integral. So what I'm going to end up doing is computing now I'm going to split it into 4 and 6-dimensional integral, like that. OK? And then they've assumed the product form for this metric. Now, the thing is, this is nothing but, by definition, the volume of the Claudio manifold. And so what's happened here is what we've gotten is, so this is 1 over 2 kappa 10 squared integral d4x square root g, r4, looking good, you know, this is looking like the 4D Einstein-Hilbert action, times the volume of the Calabi-Yau manifold. The problem is the volume of the Calabi-Yau is a scalar field in the 4D theory. What that means is that this is a non-minimal coupling of a scalar field to the scalar curvature. Right? In other words, this is completely analogous to a term of the form r phi squared or r f of phi. And if you saw one of those, if someone handed you a gravity theory and said, consider the gravity theory r f of phi, you might say, well, look, I don't want to deal with that theory. I want to make a transformation to the 4D Einstein frame such that I can do things as usual. The way you do that is you simply rescale g mu nu. Initial goes to g mu nu e. E just stands for the Einstein frame times lambda squared for some lambda, which is a function of phi. That's what you do in terms of some general field. Okay, I'm just rescaling to 4D Einstein frame. Is it clear why I want to do that? If I'm in the 4D Einstein frame, then I can then variation of this act of the action. So in 4D Einstein frame, the action is just what you learned in VR, just that period. With where now R is made from the Einstein frame metric G E. Okay, that's the definition of the frame. And the advantage of the frame is in that frame, everything is just VR. And all the complexities have been shifted into the scalar sector. They ended up in the scalar sector because if I rescale g here, well, what else do I have? I probably have lots of stuff, including, say, some potential for phi. Well, when I rescale this measure factor, I'm going to get powers of lambda rescaling v. So the kinetic terms and the potential for the scalar can get arbitrarily complicated, but at least I've insisted that the Einstein-Hilbert term is clean. Okay, so that's what I want. And this is actually a really important tool. We haven't seen this before for diagnosing instabilities, decompactification instabilities, causing something else to happen. These are usually, when a paper is published that has a decompactification instability that the authors didn't notice, it's almost always the case that they could have seen it if they had transformed to the Einstein ring. So what I'm going to do now is transform this construction to yes.
Are there words that the Einstein frame is not a physical frame? And we should be doing things in there?
Well, the Einstein frame is a very physical frame. There are some questions about, so you can cook up very complicated scenarios where something in the standard model depends on the field phi. So in particular, what I need to do here is add the Lagrangian density for the standard model. And so then the question is, do I get unusual standard model couplings from this field? The advantage, though, is that that sort of stuff is relevant standard model type things at late times, when we'll have stabilized this field anyway. So while for worrying about these instabilities, I can talk in which, sort of whichever frame I want. I just need to find the right equations of motion for the scalar field that is the volume. Okay. And it's easiest to eyeball those equations of motion in the Einstein frame. In the end, when we get to a final 4D theory, then we would indeed have to ask, if this weren't stabilized, if this remained a light field, then we'd have to worry. Okay. But I'll come to that. And more questions about why I'm doing this. Or what this is. No? Okay. So how exactly do we go about choosing the right transformation? This is exercise number one. Find lambda as a function of the scalar field v-collabial, such that one ends up in the 4D Einstein frame. This is a pretty easy exercise. In other words, just, you want to get rid of this thing by considering the scalings of the determinant of the metric and R. So the question is, what should lambda be, such that you get rid of all of the V's and show that SDDI, for an antibrand, is equal to, in Einstein's frame, as come up with from that prescription, given by that formula. Now, here I've gotten the alpha primes right. Here I may not have done so. No, I think I did. Note, if you note the dimensions of kappa 10, you can read off the dimensions of kappa 10 from here. So here, v collabial is not only is it a scalar field, it's actually a scalar field with dimensions of length to the sixth, because it's a sixth volume. Okay, and so I think all the dimensions work right. Okay, now what does this illustrate? This showed us that this action for antibrand, so if I just take an antibrand and just stick it at rest, it gives rise to a potential. And that potential is inversely proportional to the square of the collabial volume. So it's minimized at infinite volume. So that's where those runaway type potentials that I was drawing come from. Yes?
Are you saying that it's pretty hard to make the lambda stabilizing, but it's even a lot harder to have
Yeah. Definitely. because there's one extra condition. I mean, first, if you want to inflate, first you have to have a De Sitter vacuum in which you're going to end up. Then you have to make it not just metastable, you have to make it just barely unstable. You know, you don't want to have this, because that would be old inflation. You need to flatten this out. So that's one extra condition. Yes, there are some other questions?
It's a test for, right? So you would need that but it's still the same as the modular ransomware.
Right. Well, suppose I added a D3 ring. Then the contribution, that would just sort of double the contribution. So instead of this, I would have, so this is SD3 bar alone, which as you say, rightly, is an imaginary situation. But if I considered configuration for a D3 plus a D3 bar, well, I would get 2 times the brain tension over the volume of the Calabi-Yau squared times 1 plus interaction terms. And actually, I may not get to it today, but I will certainly come to, for brain and brain inflation, one is interested in not only this constant part, but the fact that if you take the brain and an antibrain and stick them both down, then you get small subleading corrections from the fact that they interact. There were some other questions there. Okay, so the lesson, oh, by the way, this doesn't have to do with just antibrains. This has to do with all sorts of sources of energy you can think of. You could try it for rat brains. I'm not going to write this down as an exercise because then, I don't know, someone may check whether you did it or something, but you could try and do this for a rat brain. It'd take just a few seconds. And you can convince yourself there's no way, you might think, oh, maybe if I wrap some bigger brains or something like that. People have this intuition, oh, if I wrap a brain around the Calabi-Yau wants to shrink. And that is a wrong intuition. Go ahead and try it. Right, do this for a D6 brain that wraps the whole Calabi-Yau. Well, you'll make a point. Do this for a D9 brain that wraps the whole Calabi-Yau and fills spacetime. You'll find it still gives a decomagnification instability. So the claim is all sensible sources of 10D energy give rise to decomagnification instabilities. Oh, yeah. Let me add one thing to this exercise. Since I set up all the steps for you here, let me define, just for convenience, I'm going to define the volume of the Calabi-Yau to be R to the 6. That, of course, does not mean that it's a cube. R is just a parameter I'm sticking in there. Find the kinetic term for R with R to the 6, the amount to be the Calabi-Yau. Okay. And if you do that, then you'll see that you've understood this dimensional reduction, because basically the kinetic term for R is going to come from this transformation that you have to do here. The reason being, when you consider the relation between R4 made from some metric G and R4e made from some metric GE, which is equal to G lambda squared, they're related not just by a constant rescaling, but by the fact that there are lots of derivatives sitting inside the Ricci scalar. When those derivatives hit lambda, they're effectively hitting V. That's where you get kinetic terms for V. Okay, so this is how dimensional reduction tells you what the kinetic terms are for the volume modulus. And that's in principle where you get the equation of motion for this volume modulus. Okay, so now that was the problem. Now let me start talking about the solution, which is modular stabilization. Okay, so first the more general problem. This decomagnification instability is just the most severe example of a very general and extremely important for string inflation problem called the Moduli problem, which is that generic string comactifications on Calabi-Yau manifolds have a very large number of gravitationally coupled scalar fields. You should think of there as being roughly hundreds of these. Gravitationally coupled light, sometimes massless scalars. Now, to understand the gravitational coupling thing, I want you to think about this one example of a modulus that we have seen already. The Calabi-Yau volume is a modulus. Its kinetic terms, as you see, come from the 10-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert term, and then and thence from the 4-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert term. So gravity is the only thing that's entered the game. These are going to be gravitational type couplings. Okay, so that's sort of the origin, that and its generalization is the origin of the gravitational strength coupling of these scalar fields. Now I'm going to show you why it's light or why there's no potential for it. Now what's wrong with this, these are typically fatal in cosmology for a lot of reasons. Well, by no means the most important, but one of them is fifth force experiments. These light fields could mediate gravitational strength interactions, which would be like some sort of Brzezinski field or something like that, or its generalization. They can give rise to variations of the visible sector couplings. Two, this one I may get to later, they store energy during inflation. That in itself is not a problem. But then they have to liberate it. And they can do two kinds of bad things. They can either photodissociate the products of BDN, and they decay with such energy that they destroy the nuclei that you synthesized, or they can live on a long time, longer than BDN times, and they can overclose the universe. So you need to arrange that the moduli are massive enough that they decouple from your theory, and they don't do these things. To get around condition two, well, if the mass of the modulus is bigger than around 30 TeV, then they decay, then the lifetime is a great deal less than 1 second. And they decay before BDN. So that's nice. What's better, though, what's more important, if the mass is actually bigger than the Hubble constant during inflation, then they don't even fluctuate. And that's the stronger condition that we're going to be looking for here. So moduli stabilization is precisely the giving of masses, the giving of large masses to all of the moduli. That's probably obvious from the name. And for today, large means large compared to Hubble constant during inflation. So once I give you a model of inflation, you'll be able to read off what h is, and you'll be able to tell me, well, m had better be large compared to h. Typically, though, h is of order 10 to the 14 GeV or thereabouts. So this is a whole lot more than 30 TeV for sure. Okay. I'm going to get into moduli stabilization. Are there questions about this?
And if you give the mass that's much bigger than 10 to the 14 GeV, wouldn't it like, get pretty close to the string sphere, like the effect on the time?
Okay, yeah, no, that's a good question. Let me talk about that now. I was going to refer to that later, but it's relevant to think about the scales involved. Of course, we have the reduced Planck mass here, and string 1 over square root alpha prime. I'm not going to worry about a possible 2 pi there. There's the KK scale, which is 1 over R, where again, R to the 6th is the volume of the Calabi-Yau. And then, this should not be obvious to those of you who haven't studied Bluxner magnifications before. You can just take it on faith here, that the mass induced in a Fluxner magnification. So I'm going to talk about Fluxner magnifications and explain why they induce masses. I'm not going to reproduce this estimate, but the scale of masses that they tend to introduce is of this order, which you'll note is a good deal smaller than R, 1 over R, which is a good deal smaller than N string, which is a good deal smaller than N prime. So we have sort of a hierarchy. Now, where do we want to build the EFT? We want to build it here. We want to build it in a stable compactification. So what does it mean to be in a compactification? I mean, to have compactified to a 4D theory, we must be working below the scale of KK. Right? We've integrated out the KK. The KK modes are, we're not accessing them directly anymore. And stable means that the mass of the moduli induced by flux that we're, is also above our cutoff. So we've gone below that. Okay, this is where we want to build the effective theory in the stable. Okay. So yeah, good question. Any other questions about the setup before I actually explain how you go about stabilizing the moduli? And I mean, just by way of general background, in case anyone is starting to think that this is going to be sort of a technical aside that has to do with a very specific class of models, well, this is something which was really central to not just string inflation, but any kind of cosmological model building in string theory. This decompactification instability I was referring to afflicts dark energy model building. The positive energy that you want to be your present ACC will again cause a decompactification. All of these other variants that are non-inflationary cosmological model building are, again, it's necessary to address the moduli problem. So really, sort of modern cosmological model building in string theory has to pass through this route of solving the moduli problem. Now, what I'm going to talk about is the best understood and most specific example, the KKLT scenario. And I hope that in 10 years' time, there will be a much better scenario. But this is arguably the best one we have on hand right now.
So, yeah. When did you avoid mentioning M string?
So, it enters the relation between M string and M blank. I guess for idiosyncratic reasons, I'm taking this to be my basic unit. And so then the relation is then that M blank squared is the volume of the Calabi-Yau over over alpha prime cubed, 1 over alpha prime. 1 over the string squared times 2 over 2 pi to the 7th or something like that. Okay. Yeah, thanks. So indeed. I can't separately say that M blank is some fixed thing. The blank. Any other questions? I'm going to start with something which isn't due to KKLT per se, but is older. It's due to Giddings, Kushner, and Polchinski. Flux compactification as a subject has an older history, which I'm not going to attempt to review. The use of flux compactifications to stabilize all of the complex structure moduli and the dilaton of a compactification of type 2b, I'm going to repeat all that later if this is due to Giddings, Kochru, and Polchinski in 2001. Okay, so starting point. Let's consider type 2B string theory on the Calabi-Yau. Then the relevant part of the action is some part you've seen before already today, the Axton-Hilbert part, minus the kinetic term for the dilaton and minus one other term that's going to be important, which is an interaction of the fluxes. Okay, so what are these symbols? Tau is the axial dilaton, C0 plus I e to the minus phi, phi being the regular dilaton, which governs the string coupling string. G3 is this combination of the NSNS and Ramon-Ramon free-form field strengths. So these are the fluxes of the flexical magnification. For this purpose, it's the free-form fluxes that are the most relevant. And what I mean by the pluses and the bar, well, by the bar, I mean complex conjugation. And G3, for the superscript plus here, I mean the part made by taking G3 and adding I times its Hopf dual. And here I mean the six dimension, the subscript six, six-dimensional Hopf dual. Okay, it's a free form in the six-dimensional Galabiao, so we just dualize it to make star V. Why do we look at this part of the potential? There are other terms in the potential, but never mind. The thing to observe is what we're after. Okay, this volume of the Galabiao is only the simplest and most easily understood of the various metric degrees of freedom associated with the Galabiao, the overall dilatation mode. But there are lots of sort of distortional modes, in particular the complex structure moduli of the Galabiao. And what we want is the potential for the metric. Basically, we want to rigidify the Galabiao and stick it in some particular configuration. And that is why I have drawn this, because as you know, the Hodge star involves the metric. And this is effectively, if I turn on some fixed G3 here. So these are closed free forms. So these are effectively cohomology elements. So what I'm interested in doing is turning on G3 on some basis of three samples. Let me do this for F3 and H3 separately. Some basis sigma 3 alpha of three cycles. And associating to each such free cycle an integer which tells me how many units of F3 I've turned on that cycle. Now, when I've done that, when I turned on that amount of flux, this term effectively turns into a potential for the remaining scalar degrees of freedom here, which are hiding in the metric, and the metric hiding in the Hodge star. Okay. And so that's why this construction of flux magnification gives a potential for the moduli. So let me say that again, because that's the whole key point. Turning on fluxes generates a potential for some of the moduli. Which ones? Specifically, it turns out, the complex structure moduli. In generic configurations, the free-form fluxes G3 give a potential for all the complex structure moduli. Well, that doesn't end the story because that's not all the moduli in the game. In particular, the overall volume has not yet entered in here. You could find that out if you played with that formula and tried rescaling the metric by a constant, you'd see that it doesn't enter that potential. Okay. One can show that this potential follows from a superpotential. Discovered by Gukov, Vaff, and Witten, integral G wedge omega. The integral is over the whole Galabiao. Omega is the covariantly constant holomorphic free zero form. And G is the same G3. And this thing appears absolutely everywhere in Buxton magnifications, and it's typically referred to as W0. Just thought of as a constant for some purposes. OK, so that actually took care of the complex structure model. Are there questions? By the way, it took care of the dilaton as well. The dilaton enters into this potential because you see the G3. So the integer data I specify is data about F3 and H3. However, to turn F3 and H3 into G3, I need to use tau. So data about what tau is then enters the potential.
This NF and H3 are the same integers that
That's right. I just used some perhaps complicated notation for specifying flux integers. A choice of fluxes is just a choice of one integer per flux per free cycle. That's what I'm just trying to write down.
Would that be an XR for me?
Pardon me?
Would that be an XR for me?
Oh, alpha, I just mean that there are a large number of free cycles in some basis of the H3, and I can specify an integer on each one for each kind of things. Okay? Right. So, and the dilaton. So the complex structure moduli and dilaton are gone, and what's left is the Ketter moduli, and in particular, the overall volume. I'm not going to talk about Ketter moduli other than the overall volume. So for today's purposes, if you don't know how to think about the other Ketter moduli, just forget about them. I'm just going to talk about the overall volume, BCY, that's been appearing in all sorts of places. OK, next step, which is going to give away part of the answer to one of your exercises, is so we have W equals to W0. And then if the associated Ketter potential for the overall volume is given by this, so what I'm talking about here, big R is the same thing that we've had everywhere. Big R to the 6 is the Calabi-Yau volume. Rho is a complex scalar field, as you can see. It's composed of two real scalar parts, R to the 4th and theta. Theta comes from the integral of C4 on a 4th. In other words, this phase here is associated to a Ramon-Ramon potential. The reason I say this gives away part of the answer is, once you have a Ketter potential, you can compute kinetic terms. And what you can do is compute the kinetic terms from this, and then compare them to the kinetic terms that you can derive directly from the dimensional reduction. And you'll see that people are ready to use this formula. But this is a much more convenient way to package it. Okay. Problem is that the superpotential does not depend on R. There's a very valuable argument for seeing that, which uses the shift symmetry of the axion. I'm going to skip over that for now, and I can talk about it later if you're interested. Does not depend on R to any order in perturbation theory. And here by perturbation theory, I mean perturbations in alpha prime over R squared, the so-called sigmoidal perturbation theory. I'm not talking about the genus expansion of string world sheets here. I'm working with tree level strings. Okay? To any order in this perturbation theory, W does not depend on R. It can only depend on R non-perturbative. So W is equal to W0 plus possibly some e to the minus r to some power. The problem is, question mark could be 0, and number, we need to know what number is. Okay. So this is the next, and this is the key step of the KKLT proposal. What I said over there was from the Giddings-Kaczor-Polchinski proposal. Now we're getting into what KKLT added. KKLT is Kaczor, Kalash, Linde, and Trinity. This was done in 2003. What they proposed was to take a GKP construction, Giddings-Kaczor-Polchinski construction, a flexure magnification like this, and add a non-perturbative effect of this form, question mark e to the minus r to some power. Okay. But they had a specific idea for where that was going to come from. So let's consider superangular string. N equals 1, SU, n, different n's of course, superangulars. And I want to consider the pure glue, well, pure super glue, I guess, theory. The theory is with no matter multiplies. So the only fermions in the theory are the KGMs. Okay. With gauge coupling G and cut off MUV. Well, I didn't add any fermions. This theory is asymptotically free. In the infrared, it gets very strongly coupled. It generates a superpotential. OK, so now I'm going to refer to the famous work of Novikov, Shiffman, Weinstein, and Zakharov, and subsequent works that tell us that the generated superpotential is stuff I'm putting in parentheses here, and you don't need to care about it if you want to see the details, there they are. That's the normalization in an appropriate scheme. But the really important thing to remember is there's an e to the minus 8 pi squared over n g squared. So this is a phase part. Here g is just the real part of the gauge couple. But so now I'll make w proportional. It's proportional up to a phase to this expression. Okay. What does this have to do with anything? Oh, and by the way, as far as buzzwords go, this is W is proportional to the VEV of a Gaugino bilinear lambda, lambda, trace lambda, lambda. So this is called Gaugino condensation. But for almost all purposes, you don't need to think about the Gauginos at all. You just need to know what's the dynamically generated superpotential. Okay, so what this has to do, how this has to do with the other stuff we're talking about, is as follows. In this compactification of the type 2B theory on the Calabi-Yau threefold, I could consider the following configuration. Sorry, this is going to be sort of hard to follow it just from the picture. The outer circle is the whole Calabi-Yau, which is a sigma manifold. This is some four-cycle sigma 4. And what I'm imagining doing is wrapping some D7 brands on this four-cycle. Why D7 brand? Because 7 is 4 plus 3, so the spatial dimensions of the brain. It spatially, it wraps this four cycle here, and it also fills out space-time. Okay, so it's a space-time filling brain, which means it gives rise to a regular gauge theory in four dimensions. And if I have n of them, well, depending, I put a condition on that this is a super Yang-Mills theory with no matter fields. So you can trust me on this. If you impose a particular set of conditions on sigma 4, then you can arrange that the 4D theory that you generate is exactly that thing. Okay. Questions about this?
Can you explain again? What
Yes.
What is the membrane? What's the idea?
Okay, so the idea is I want, there's one missing link which I haven't even started to expose, which is this dynamically generated superpotential here is going to correspond to this non-perturbative term there. Okay, let's leave aside that connection for now. Let's just try and understand how is it, why is it that I'm trying to engineer with this construction that gauge theory? For the reason that I want, that I think I can engineer that particular gauge theory here is, well, let's see. If I want a 4D gauge theory, I need, first of all, to fill out 3 plus 1 dimensions. And I need something else. I need some stack of rings. So I've got a variety of ways that I can make a 4-dimensional gauge theory. I can have a stack of p plus 3 brains. If I have n p plus 3 brains on a p cycle, then in 3 plus 1 dimensions, there's space filling, space-time filling. And the open string degrees of freedom, so you know I have some open strings that live both here and here. And in 4 dimensions, what I experience is effectively the dimensionally reduced gauge theory. Now, so I could have picked any p here. But because I'm in type 2D, I needed to pick some odd dimensional brain. And because of the detailed requirements of this construction, D5 brains end up typically breaking supersymmetry. So the D7 brain is sort of the thing that one stumbles across. Sorry, that's probably unsatisfying. So if anyone wants to ask a detailed version of a question about this, then, or any even non-detailed question.
Why do you want to fill out the space-time?
I want to fill out the space-time because I want to have a... So I have some in this 4D picture, I have some gauge inner condensate. I want to stabilize the commagnification volume at all points in space-time homogeneously. I don't want to have a dilute gas of stuff that holds the volume in. So the other thing you might try and do, leaving KKLT aside, but just generally, you might say, oh, I want to stabilize the commagnification by wrapping D6 brains on a Calabi-Yau. So here's space-time, here's the Calabi-Yau, and I just wrap D6 brains. What that gives you in space-time is a dust of very massive points. And the problem is, if you try and make a De Sitter vacuum with such a dust, those guys dilute just like matter. They behave like matter. And so what that means is that in different points in your space-time, you sort of pin down the volume. But in between, where you don't have a dilute dust of these things, you don't have a dense dust of these things, then the thing sort of blows out, the magnification thing. So that's why I want to do a homogeneous. Any other questions? So let me try and finish up KKLT. All right, so this is how we engineer that gauge theory. And the final step is that one can show that 1 over g squared is proportional to r to the fourth, where r to the fourth is the volume of this 4 cycle. Is this still too confusing? Should I say something more about it? Okay. Well, what that tells us, if you compare the formula I gave you there for the dynamically generated superpotential and this expression for the gauge coupling, exercise. Show this, that 1 over g squared is proportional to r to the fourth. Now let me give you some assumptions that will make this very easy to do. Don't try and do a 4 cycle in a Calabi-Yau, because then you might get confused about the normalization. Just do an isotropic in a T6, an isotropic 6 torus, which is just S1r to the sixth. Okay, what I mean by this symbol, I mean it's simply the product of 6 circles, each of radius r, and they're sort of orthogonal. It's the simplest imaginable 6 torus. Okay? In such a thing, wrap a D7 brain along 4 of the circles and show that this proportionality holds. Okay? That should be very, very easy. All you have to do is look up the 10-dimensional action for the 7th brain and dimensionally reduce it. In fact, you probably don't even have to do that. If you wanted to get equals here, you would probably have to look it up. But you can probably just think of what the 10-dimensional action has to be and get this proportion. Okay, so we now finish up with this setup. So what KPLT has then accomplished by this trick of engineering is they've taken, following Giddings, Cutter, and Polchinski, freeform fluxes and stabilize the complex structure model. From which W from the flux is just integral G wedge omega, which W zero. So then the W total is equal to W zero plus, and then here, then in the notation of KPLT, they just introduce some constants big A and little a, which we don't need to worry about. Okay, if you're very paranoid, you might say, well, what if big A is zero? And that's something that people have thought about very carefully. And there are many cases where it is zero. But for the moment, let's assume big A is non-zero. Then this is what the total superpotential is. And then the Keller potential is, as I wrote it before, 3 log rho plus rho bar. So I've more or less justified all these ingredients for you. At least this Keller potential is going to be justified by the exercise. And then this more or less stated. And this one, I sort of hand-waved and showed you the geometric engineering type thing you have to do. The upshot of all this, I am not going to actually show you what it looks like when you try and find solutions for this configuration. I'll just show you what the potential looks like. So here's the potential for rho, V of rho. What KPLT finds is solutions of this form. Susie, ADS4 times Calabi-Yau solution. So their achievement was effectively to dig enough things out of a very messy toolbox that they could assemble all of the ingredients to make a supersymmetric stable compactification. Literally stable, I mean supersymmetric, without moduli. Okay, all the moduli are stable. That's the key. Then they do one more thing. I'm not going to go into detail about now. And that is to add a source of supersymmetry breaking they had an antibrain to this is the phrase everybody uses, although sort of perhaps not the best way of thinking about it, to uplift, in other words, with the same axes here, potential goes from being of this form to being of that form. And that is the metastable de Sitter vector. Okay, so so what I'm going to talk about next time is how do you use KPLT as a tool to make realistic spring inflation models. And I'm going to try and describe some of the predictions and the quantum gravity issues. And as I was emphasizing at the start, not in every case do we have an interesting prediction or an interesting quantum gravity issue. But I'll exhibit some cases with interesting predictions and some cases with interesting quantum gravity issues. Any questions? Okay, that's it for now.